Groucho, Mets.
And I am Tuesday, May 31st, 2005. It's a special edition of the WBAI Fund Drive. We're glad to see you today. We are going to present our 9/11 and State Terror Premium. That's the special 2-CD program of Ralph's presentation at the International Citizens Inquiry that took place in Toronto 1 year ago. Today we're going to start with the first part of the presentation. Now on this almost 2-hour CD, we have Ralph discussing the origins of 9/11, the history of false flag operations and why 9/11 is a false flag operation, the cast of characters, and he goes so far as to discuss the Vatican too, and as well as the Israeli Mossad and its role in 9/11 and other intelligence operations. He also brings in the situation of the bombing in Madrid and why what occurred is not what you read in the press. So let's go on. It's 9/11 and State Terror, and it includes the presentation by Ralph, a panel discussion, and then questions and answers from Ralph.
I want to thank the organizers of the International Inquiry here in Canada for allowing me to come and speak before you. Express my appreciation to Ian Woods and to Michelle Chosadovsky and all of those who have worked so hard to make this a reality over this series of days. If you've looked at your newspapers today, I'm sure you could not fail to note the headlines, Al-Qaeda plans to hit U.S. hard, two Canadians amongst list of terror suspects. And inevitably and inexorably, we are, of course, informed that these putative suspects are linked to none other than Mohammed Atta, and the means through which their presumptive whereabouts were determined by what was referred to by Robert Mueller and John Ashcroft as an increase in the chatter. Now, they seem to be very able, very skillful at determining the amount of chatter without ever being able to locate its origins, notwithstanding their echelon and their hardware and their electronic spying and their satellite apparatus, which enables them to determine these things very easily, they fail to find the chatterers. And indeed, the terrorists, as they're referred to, are not easily discerned. I have some special intelligence for you as to what allows that to be possible. The reason is that the terrorists actually look rather like George Bush, Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and so on, except that for the most part up to now, they have not been so readily identifiable. I think we're in the process of changing that. And indeed, tonight I want to, in the time allotted, to address some of the issues pertaining to what is a false flag operation and how the events of 9/11 are paradigmatic in that they reveal the hand of the state and of structured power in their unfolding and in their meaning and in their significance and in their import for all of us. But frankly, I think it's essential for us all that we do not have to reinvent the wheel each time that those who have control of our society visited upon us an event which is essential to the perpetration of yet another crime and yet another predation upon peoples in the world. I'll just take a moment to mention the fact that I had the pleasure and opportunity of working over a decade with Bertrand Russell during the years that I lived in London. Now, Bertrand Russell was raised by his grandfather when his grandfather was in his 80s. His grandfather, Lord John, had actually introduced the Reform Act of 1832 and had visited Napoleon at Elba. And Bertie used to say, history stops in 1815. After that, it's gossip, family gossip. I suggest that we need to recapture that history and an understanding of its significance for the events of today. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the Communist Manifesto wrote that the bourgeoisie has at last, since the establishment of modern industry and of the world market, conquered for itself in the modern representative state exclusive sway politically. The executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the entire bourgeoisie, they wrote. And they stated as well that this new capitalist order has resolved personal worth into exchange value, and in place of the numberless indefeasible chartered freedoms, has set up that single unconscionable freedom, free trade. In one word, exploitation, veiled by religious and political illusion, substituting naked, shameless, direct, and brutal conquest. Richard Goodwin, who was a young man of 28, a functionary in the State Department during the Kennedy administration, wrote not so long ago on the 8th of February an article in the New York Times called Making the Facts Fit the Case for War. And he opens this piece as follows. In 1846, President James Polk announced that Mexican troops had fired on American soldiers on American soil, and he took the country to a war that gained it California, New Mexico, Arizona, amputating a substantial part of Mexico at the time. And Goodwin says, was the disputed soil ours? No. Did Polk distort the information he had? Yes. He wanted the territory, and he needed a war to get it. He goes on to describe how, when at the age of 28, he was in the presence of the National Security Council for an operation intended to take over Cuba and defeat and destroy and remove from power the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro. And he describes how he was in the presence of a series of generals and officers, and Richard Bissell, the legendary figure and the man responsible for a series of predations and covert operations and special operations and eliminations, assassinations, and so forth. At one point, Bissell turned to a general sitting beside him and said rather calmly, "Don't we have an NIE on this?" Referring to a classified national intelligence estimate indicating that the U.S. would meet with rather little opposition in Cuba. The general nodded. And Goodwin comments, of course, that NIE did not exist. So we see that the nature of our structure of power is such that events of this nature are handled in camera. It was the former president of Avis and American Express, Robert Townsend, who in his book Up the Organization described how the number of people who control what he called the commanding heights of the economy of the society are approximately 5,000. They average about 14 corporate directorships per person. They integrate the banking and corporate hegemony over capital. And the state is but the vehicle for both subsidizing their needs and imposing their rule. He said, they look upon this country as their own whorehouse, and for them every president is their private towel boy. The New York Times tells us that about 1% now of the population owns and controls some 90% of the national wealth. So if we look back upon our history, and we examine the process through which power has been concentrated and consolidated, and the nature of its reach, and the compulsions that prevail upon capital in seeking control of markets to impose its hegemony and to extract cheap labor and free resources belonging to others, it is a familiar and sordid and constant legacy and tale. "We must have the Chinese market or we shall have a revolution," proclaimed Senator Frye. 1891. Quincy Adams used the Christian principles in the expression of the same thing. "The moral obligation upon which our relations are based is exclusively and entirely the Christian proverb, 'Love thy neighbor as thyself.' The Chinese," he added, "are not Christian. They do not consider that they should love their neighbors as themselves. They reject the commercial principle. They will not accept our control. It is high time that this outrage against human decency was ceased." President McKinley, "The Lord has said that the United States has the duty of educating and elevating the Philippines into Christian civilization, and by the grace of God to do all that we can for our brother nation for whom Christ also died." And he adds, "The Philippines are ours forever, and right behind them is the immense Chinese market. We shall not leave either one." Well, Every major spokesperson for capital has articulated these themes, whatever nominal political association in the complex of political parties owned and possessed and represented and dominated by capital in our society. Woodrow Wilson was equally explicit. If we do not enforce our commerce abroad, we cannot have any liberty in this country. It is a luxury we cannot afford. Our industry is at the point where it collapses. Unless we have control of a world market, we must have foreign domination. Herbert Hoover, foreign control is more important for us to ensure the stable and normal functioning of our capitalist economy, a greater importance than home consumption. And Franklin Roosevelt. Here is the president of the National Industrial Conference Board, Virgil Jordan, December 10, 1940. Whatever the outcome of this war, we have taken the road of imperialism on an economic plane, as on all other planes of life. Yes, some fear this word imperialism, so well known, and to some menacing. Most people prefer to mask this under the more acceptable formulation of defense of a Western Hemisphere. But we have no choice but to continue on this road as we have for the past century, beginning with the seizure of the continent, proceeding to the annexation of Cuba and the Philippines. This empire sees its prospects beyond the southern part of the hemisphere and expanding west of the Pacific. The scepter must fall in the hands of the United States. Every major spokesperson articulating this theme as the defining element of imperial policy. And if we look carefully at this structure of economy at the height of the New Deal in the middle of the second term, the rate of unemployment in the United States was exactly comparable to that of Herbert Hoover under the Great Depression. The percentages employed in the arms industry were relatively small. And within 18 months, this was reversed. With massive armament, the percentages of unemployment now fell to what they had been in military employment prior, and those of the unemployed in percentage were now engaged in the arms industry. Capitalism addicted to military production like an addict needs his fix and in ever-increasing doses. And that is the process that drives forward the national security apparatus that defines power and determines policy. Every single foray has been characterized by events analogous to those of 9/11. Remember the Maine? They blew up a ship in Havana Harbor and imputed it to the Spanish to provide the opportunity and the pretext for seizing Cuba and the Philippines, unfolding the first truly genocidal war, taking the lives of nearly 3 million Filipinos. And World War I itself, through the sinking of the Lusitania, as Colin Simpson so amply documented in his book, followed a process through which that Lusitania was signaled not only to German submarines, but to the insurance companies by the owners and by American and British intelligence at the time. And so with Pearl Harbor. And so, indeed, with the Korean War, as I.F. Stone so well documented in his book, The Hidden History of the Korean War. And then we have Operation Northwood, 1962, in which the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, in the councils of the National Security Council, laid forth a plan on which every member of the Joint Chiefs signed off, which called for the hijacking of airplanes and flying them into buildings in Washington and in Miami, the random killing of U.S. citizens and civilians, of course, in cities in the United States, anticipating the blowing up of the rocket carrying John Glenn astronaut and imputing all of this again to the Cuban Revolution and to Fidel Castro as a casus belli, with the expected result of a population driven through hysteria into an acquiescence in a long prepared undertaking. Kennedy brothers had other plans in mind. According to Robert McNamara, and they asked for a backup plan that didn't show the hand so clearly of the U.S. intelligence services. And they got one. It called for special forces wearing Cuban uniforms and invading Guantanamo Bay. The paradigm. That's how it's done. That's how it's always happened. whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin or whatever other imperial adventure, it proceeds in that fashion. Staged events, false flag operations, imputing responsibility to demonized others who are but the present victims to be smashed, crushed, exploited, conquered, and brushed aside. Since 1964, every United States administration has prepared for direct seizure of Arab oil. Here's how it was described by a Pentagon analyst in commentary, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention, January 1975. Without intervention, there is the distinct prospect of an economic and political disaster bearing more than a superficial resemblance to that of the 1930s. And then they go on to describe the Arab shoreline of the Gulf and that of Mesopotamia as a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. A rapid deployment force, a plan embraced by every administration and codified by Jimmy Carter on August 25, 1977 in a secret presidential directive, PD-18, calling for a rapid intervention force of 100,000 troops to seize directly Arab oil in the Middle East. By 1979, Lawrence Mosher formulated it as the 100,000-man quick strike force consisting of multiple divisions deployable, and then he states, for the Pentagon and defense officials, we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can talk of our quick strike force. It may turn out that boogeyman may not be defined the same in Arabic as in English. So I insist, therefore, that we look at these events in their proper context as the continuation of a species of rule that requires not just assembling, but the perpetuation of staged events. Now, many of us have been up against the claim and the charge that what we are doing is indulging in what is called conspiracy theory, right? There's a certain irony about that, because the most frequently invoked juridical tool for prosecutors at every judicial level in the United States, municipal, county, state, and federal, is that of conspiracy. Conspiracy to defraud, RICO, conspiracy to do this, conspiracy to do that. The only conspiracy in which they have vanishing little interest is that of our rulers. And indeed, they fail to understand, because they choose not to. It's what the Jesuits call invincible ignorance. They know, but they prefer not to know. That power proceeds on a completely closed and clandestine basis when it is illicit, when it is concentrated, when it is concealed, when it doesn't flow through the formal institutions, as is the overwhelmingly documented character and case of power in American society, and in North American society, I should add. Now, in that context, I have to say that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, those who rule in our society, those who had obtained over $9.3 trillion for the Pentagon in a space of 40 years, more than the combined value of everything produced in the society, taken together, were confronted by the absence of a rationale for soliciting and for securing trillions of dollars for the defense apparatus, the maw of imperial control, and that industrial compounded structure of capital that is wholly dependent upon it. And there you have the genesis of the category of terror as a substitute and a replacement for the communist menace and that of subversion and the menace of the Soviet Union, the ideological integument, the category of terror. And it doesn't arise out of nothing. Instructively, a particular individual, a young man at the time of 28, named Benjamin Netanyahu, was induced by George Shultz and Bush to organize a series of conferences on the category and the prospect of terror. And by the way, the Israeli weekly Haier disclosed that Benjamin Netanyahu operated under four different names and four different social security numbers for the Central Intelligence Agency: Benjamin Netanyahu, Benjamin Netai, John J. Sullivan, and John J. Sullivan Jr. Yes. A series of conferences on the prospect of terror. They were held in Washington, D.C. They were held in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv with Secretary of State George Shultz, J. Jack Hemp, Senators Alan Cranston, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, FBI Director William Webster, Gene Kirkpatrick, Moshe Arendt, who served as Minister of Defense, Yitzhak Rabin, then Minister of Defense, and replicated again in Washington with Bush Sr. present with Joint Chiefs of Staff in tow. The category of terror. And indeed, at that time, a document was prepared by the Mossad, a figure named Oded Yinon, called A Strategy for the 1980s, which stipulated that the task before those who rule was to fragment each Middle Eastern country, notably Arab states, in their turn, into their ethnic and religious components, replicating what Abba Iban called the millet system of the Ottoman Empire. And they spelled it out. Iraq was high amongst the targets, but not Iraq alone. Iraq was considered a target of opportunity because of the importance of its oil. But this was not confined to Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Egypt, all in their turn were to be targeted and indeed fragmented and dissolved as a functioning state because imperialism had reached the point, it was discerned, where they could no longer afford the comprador elements who engaged in flight capital they needed, and they were determined to impose direct seizure of resources and direct military rule. And they required a rationale for all of that. It's interesting, you know, on the first anniversary of 9/11, a series of articles occurred, one by Richard Bernstein in the New York Times, explaining that the linchpin event for 9/11 was that of 1993. And another by Bill Keller, but a few days later, called The Sunshine Warrior, which described how, at a meeting at the War College with the Army Chief of Staff, and General Eric Shinseki as such, young Pentagon analyst Wolfowitz, it was disclosed, had directed a secret assessment in 1979, a dozen years before Desert Storm, then orchestrated by a series of organizations, the American Enterprise Institute, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Defense Policy Board, all of that apparatus of the Likud wing of the Israeli state, now central to the designs of imperialism, the cat's paw instrument in the Arab East, now at the center of imperial policy. The category of terror. Well, you know, in 1993, we did indeed have what might in some respects be called a dry run. And even today, in the Toronto Star, these invented figures who are again associated with the demonic Mohammed Atta are said to have had their instruction not only through Mohammed Atta's involvement in the events of 9/11, but in the precedent of the World Trade Center events of 1993. Well, let's look at that briefly for one moment, because it indeed is a linchpin event. Imad Ali Salem is the person who went into the mosque of the blind Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Rahman, in Brooklyn and in New Jersey. And he solicited the presence at meetings of young Arab men at these mosques on a need-to-know basis. And he proceeded to make a series of proposals, which involved bringing things to station points and safe houses. And he indeed would supply what he called the necessaries. They were explosives. And then he expanded upon his proposals to include what are now called the landmark events. The blowing up of the Brooklyn Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the George Washington Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, the United Nations itself. Brothers and sisters, Imad Ali Salem was a high-level operative in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and a long history both in that capacity and in Egyptian intelligence. He wore a wire to every one of these meetings. And he made a transcript of every single recorded meeting he had. And those transcripts were deposed in the New York office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, 50 file boxes for 6 months antecedent to the event. The person who organized the safe house in the Ryder rental van, it turns out, is a character named Guzi Hadass, a Mossad operative, and Matara, the Mossad and Shin Bet, Israeli intelligence communication network, disclosed that these events were in preparation with prior knowledge by both Shin Bet and Mossad for some time previous. Confirmed in Haaretz, 1993 was indeed a predicate. False flag operations, the paradigm of what became 9/11.
You know, as we're listening to 9/11 and the terrorist state, it brings to mind the fact that shortly after 9/11, the Washington Post carried a piece called CIA's Targeted Killing Missions. Armed with new authority from President Bush for a global campaign, the Central Intelligence Agency is preparing clandestine missions expressly aimed at killing specified individuals. Drawing on classified legal memoranda, one written for Bill Clinton in 1998 and one since the attacks of September 11th, the Bush administration has concluded that executive orders banning assassination do not prevent the president from singling out for death by covert action those who are targeted by the Central Intelligence Agency. There, quote, there's nothing involved in this operation that isn't being debated by someone somewhere, but our opportunities are pretty clear to those who have the top secret code word clearance and the need to know, said a senior intelligence official. Hey, that's the Washington Post, October 01. Now, in today's newspaper, the New York Times, CIA expanding battle under guise of charter flights, and it goes through it. The airplanes of Aero Contractors Limited take off from Johnston County Airport, disappear over the scrub mines and fields of tobacco and sweet potatoes. Nothing about the sleepy southern setting hints of foreign intrigue. Nothing gives away the fact that Aero's pilots are bus drivers of the battle, sent on super secret missions to Baghdad, Cairo, Tashkent, and Kabul.
Well, Ralph, they say the battle against terrorism, the New York Times supporting the concept that there is a battle against terrorism, when in fact, as Ralph reveals in 9/11 and the terrorist state, this is a set-up job.
Well, yes, but you see what they're doing here is they have a whole series of private air corporations that are fronts for the Central Intelligence Agency. It's an important piece in the New York Times. And they are dropping CIA paramilitary officers in places around the world. They disappear people. They murder them. They take them into custody where they're tortured and never heard from again. The article is an elaboration of this. Hey, the terror state and the false flag operations are facilitating what essentially is the Nazification of and criminalization of the state in its entirety. And I go through this with today's newspaper in relation to not just the events of 9/11, but the promised terror events of the state, which they will impose yet again, to emphasize how essential it is that the information that is provided, analysis that is afforded, and the ability to put the pieces together is what we can do with taking aim because of the existence of Free Speech Radio and WBAI.
Ralph, why don't you run down some of the topics that you covered in this presentation,
well,
because we're only playing an excerpt.
Yes, of course. Well, the concept of the governing concept is that of the false flag operation. As I tried to show historically, and I think it's essential for us to keep this in mind, brothers and sisters, 9/11 does not just emerge suddenly out of nothing. There's an entire history of these sorts of events. Every time the United States has embarked upon an imperial campaign, it has prepared the public and justified its actions by false flag operations. Just like the Reichstag fire, so we cite the examples that go back across American history for the seizure of other people's resources and declarations of war, and then the deployment of our own working class as cannon fodder in the pursuit of these wars. We deal with Operation Gladio, which for 40 years in Italy was a clandestine operation of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Italian Intelligence Services, in which they carried out kidnappings and assassinations, often under the banner of the Red Brigades, which were, as it turns out, wholly constructed intelligence operations of their own, even the kidnapping of former Prime Minister Moro. Yes, and the platform event, brothers and sisters, for the bombing of the Madrid railroad station took place in 1984 in Bologna, where the CIA and intelligence carried out almost identically a bombing of the railroad station in Bologna, which was attributed to the Red Terrorists, etc. And all of this by way of consolidating control for right-wing governments in Italy and for disappearing literally thousands of people under the guise of a war against terror.
And Ralph, the Operation Gladio was run by William Colby, one of the architects of the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and that leads us back to the involvement of the CIA once again in the renditions of the article today in the New York Times about the charter flights. This is something that had been exposed by the Chicago Tribune before, about a year ago, and which we discussed at length on Taking Aim in some of our programs. Today, however, let's return to 9/11 and the terror state.
We cover as well, Maya, the false flag operations of Israeli intelligence, including the Achille Lauro, including the bombing of the Berlin discotheque, including the staged operations in Libya, in which the Libyan government was said to have been planning assassinations and terror operations, which were all communicated through Mossad communications systems. All these particular operations disclosed in Ostrovsky's book on By Way of Deception and The Other Side of Deception and Beit Halami's book. We cite all that particular data and integrate it to an understanding of what 9/11 is really about. We examine exactly the modalities of the operation in Madrid, which were imputed not just to Mohammed Atta's associates, but it's disclosed that the town of Tarragona in Spain was supposedly the very place where Mohammed Atta and those responsible for the Madrid bombings had first planned 9/11 itself. All of this exposed and revealed for the fabrication that it is. The hand of U.S. and Spanish intelligence exposed in the process of this presentation. I mention this because these are seamless, continued applications of a policy of terrorizing the peoples of the world to subject us to a program and a permanent agenda of constant war, and above all, to prepare us through fear for being unable to respond to the next staged event, which will happen, as they continually promise us, create the conditions for martial law. They're not hiding what they're preparing to do, brothers and sisters, but we need to be able to call it by its name, to identify this with evidence. That's what this programming does. That's what this talk in Toronto concentrates and synopsizes. I think you'll find it invaluable as a reference and as a source of information and as a point of analysis. The six-part series, brothers and sisters, Creating the Next Pandemic, isolates and identifies the roots and sources of things like Marburg virus, Ebola, and the SARS and avian flu virus, and documents how these viruses are actually laboratory creations. We cite the evidence chapter and verse. There are references to this as well in the 9/11 presentation in Toronto. It's an attempt to integrate the panoply of measures that the criminalized state, which is the apparatus of control today of our ruling class, visits upon the world. And again, once we address very specifically the attempts to dismiss whatever we have to say, what you say, what we say, with reference to the category of conspiracy, why we're simple conspiracy mongers, as we point out in this discussion, the irony of all that is that the most frequently invoked category for every juridical level of punitive justice in the United States, whether local, municipal, county, state, or federal, the most frequently invoked category by prosecutors is the category of conspiracy. Conspiracy to defraud, conspiracy to steal money and property, ever invoked by prosecutors. The only conspiracy that they are unable and unwilling to examine is the standard behavior of the rulers themselves. We look at that, we analyze it, we strip away the facade. That's the merit, if I say so myself, of this presentation and of the kind of dialogue that the people who have spent many decades in investigating this work and in analyzing it shared together at this conference and came to a kind of crystallized essence in the panel discussions that followed. We examine it since I have to mention to you that that particular inquiry occurred not long before the elections. We examine, in fact, what is the real structure of power in the United States in relation to the two fiction parties, what we called the One Big Property Party with Two Names. Bear in mind, brothers and sisters, that the national security advisors that John Kerry and the Democratic Party had put forward included Rand Beers, who was part of Reagan's FEMA program succeeding Oliver North, and proceeded to operate with the death squads in Colombia, and then moved on to George Bush, George W. Bush, where he was the person working with Tom Ridge in operating the color codes for putative terror threats. This is the same figure who was going to be John Kerry's national security advisor. Then there's William Perry, who was the former Secretary of Defense, who was the point man for merger of Lockheed and Martin Marietta. I go through this because we attempt to show that the facade of the two parties is what deceives people. In a very real sense, the Democratic Party is the syphilis of the working class. It poisons the body politic and it renders people impotent because it canalizes potential impetus for change into a party that is owned and operated for capital. Every single administration, be it Republican or Democratic, partakes of the same intelligence apparatus that brings us the events of 1993 or 9/11 and carries on the clandestine operations without missing a beat. And I think that the attempts to examine the actual structure of power and how the game is played in relation to events of 9/11 is ever more important for us because we are continually bombarded with the false option. You know, I like to cite the expression that the technique of infamy is to invent two lies and get people arguing heatedly over which one of them is true. On Free Speech Radio, we try to cut through all of that. We like to expose the fact that we don't have to choose between two implementers of the same strategy on behalf of the very rulers who have control of our society. We can do better than that. We can mobilize in our own name. We can build a political alternative that is not part of the process of our oppression. That's what this programming is designed to achieve. And I think you will find it integrated within the insights and the data that's presented in 9/11 in the terror state.
And now more than ever, as you'll read in the newspaper today at United Airlines, where AMFAC has agreed to the dismantling of the defined benefit pension plan, one of the incredible gains of the working class, where when you retire after working for many, many years, you can be assured of a steady income each month. And this has now been destroyed at United Airlines, setting the stage for destroying it in corporations throughout the United States and attacking this with the public sector workers, too. Bringing it all together from the false flag operations of the Spanish-American War with the United States, blowing up the ship in Havana Harbor, the Maine, through the Philippines, through 1993 with the attack on the World Trade Center, the set-up attack by the FBI and other intelligence agencies, and then internationally, including Madrid. And bringing it all together is Ralph Schoenman's important presentation at the Toronto Citizens Inquiry. Ralph.
Again, in today's New York Times, brothers and sisters, quote, behind a surprisingly thin cover of rural hideaways, front companies, and shell corporations that share officers that exist only on paper, the Central Intelligence Agency has expanded its air operations as it pursues suspects around the world. The planes are regularly supplemented by private charters operated by real companies tied to the agency, including aero contractors and Florida companies, Pegasus Technologies, Tepper Aviation. Indeed, this article points out that this is the little continuation of what Air America had done throughout the years of the war in Vietnam across every administration. The battle has refocused and expanded the CIA's air operations, and they are now a major company, a series of companies, in fact, according to Dun and Bradstreet. They are literally kidnapping and assassinating people across the world with impunity, as the New York Times today makes clear. This is but the elucidation of what we set forth in that very presentation. The terror state is what the ruling class has imposed upon us. It is this documentation which makes this analysis available to you so that when an article appears such as this one in today's New York Times, you have a context in which to place it. You have a structure of power that you understand with which to see the meaning of these events. These are not random occurrences. They are not rogue elephant operations. They are central to the way the state operates in America. That's what the programming elucidates. That's what the premium presents. Please support it. Keep the understanding available to us all. Deepen the analysis. Maintain the struggle.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@patbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. And we have our programs archived at www.takingaim.info. And we are so glad to be with you, and we'll be back with you next week.
Tiki tiki no bin yai, tiki tiki no bin yai, ta tan ta.